It's time for the Artist Friends Podcast.
Hi, I'm Diane Hunt. I am an impressionist realist painter connecting with nature through my brush. I work in oil paint and watercolor, and I live in the countryside of Maryland's Eastern Shore, not far from the Chesapeake Bay. You can find me online at dianehuntstudio.com and on Facebook and Instagram at Diane Hunt Studio.
Hi, I'm Constance Brosnan of Steve Brosnan's Jewelry Designs. I live in Oklahoma on a prairie. And I make handmade jewelry in silver, copper, and brass. I'm an artist that paints. I paint pastels and oils sometimes.
Hello, this is Clyde J. Kale. I'm the host of this podcast. I am an emerging representational artist. I do historic renderings, seascapes, landscapes, botanicals, birds, and whatnot. Tide illustrative hand in watercolor, tin and ink, and acrylic paints. And I live in Oklahoma City. Well, I hope everybody had a happy, nice, and fulfilling Thanksgiving. This is Clyde J. Kale, and you are listening to another episode of the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 125 for November the 29th, our last episode for the month of November. And I'm here with my two best artist friends, Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Constance. Hello, everybody.
Hello, Constance.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Diane. Hello, everybody.
You guys have a nice Thanksgiving?
Yeah, it was nice, quiet.
Yeah, well, it was nice and quiet. It was. I enjoyed it.
Anyways, me and you guys were making fun of me of my 14-pound turkey. You know, how long it took me to eat it. And I will confess, I love turkey. I finished it up last night. So it only took me about 3 or 4 days.
That's a lot of turkey. Well, there's a lot of buns in turkey also, so yeah.
So it was good and nutritious. Okay. For our listeners, if you go to www.talkartpodcast.com, that's talkartpodcast.com, there's the information link. And I thought since we got on the subject of colors and art history, I thought we would continue a little bit of our discussion of colors. And I came across a video about the master stained glass artist. This was a really, really enjoyable video of the different colors. And believe it or not, I didn't even write the guy's name down. It was about...
it was about Rowan LeConte. Cohen?
I think so.
Rowan. It was three different artists that ended up working on those windows.
Well, since you got the notes, Constance, you want to start out for our listeners how it started and Rowan.
How do you pronounce his last name? It's LeComp.
I'm not even going to begin.
Comte, I think.
Yeah.
Huh?
LeComte, I think.
LeComte. And then Dieter Gold. I'm not good at pronouncing. Goldkugel, is that how you pronounce his last name?
We'll leave it at that.
I'm not sure about his last name. Dieter was they talked about.
Dieter. He was the glass cutter. That worked with growing. And then and toward the end, Mary Clark Higgins, she worked with Rowan to complete the windows that were put in the cathedral. And then she, after he passed away, the other two passed away, she ended up installing the windows that they didn't get to, but we can get into that later, but they ended up not being part of the installation. But
what I've always admired about stained glass is, I mean, really good stained glass, it has to be seen in the churches. And if it is really, really good, the way the light comes through, you know, the colors reflect out into the, you know, into the church space, it's just magnificent. And I've seen stained glass in different, you know, contemporary styles or whatever, but it doesn't evoke the same emotion as the stained glass in, you know, in the churches. And when I was over in, lived in Europe, I got a chance to see quite a bit of it, a lot of it. And it is very, you know, it's just beautiful. But what
it just brings the inside of a church to life. Right. And it's not just the stained glass, because the stained glass by itself is just the glass. But what brings it to life is these artists who actually put the paint that they put on it afterwards, and then it's baked, that the art that they put on it is baked onto the glass. The glass is gorgeous, but they actually do the artwork on top of the stained glass, and that's what gives it the actual character and beauty that tells the stories that it tells in the church.
And that what, like what I was going to say, what really impressed me that I didn't know this video showed is that there was such a collaboration. And when we think of artists, you know, most of us solitary artists, you know, working on a project from the beginning to the end. No, this was complete collaboration. I mean, Rowan went and would pencil in, do all the pen work and the pencil work of the, come up with the design. And then for a, you know, commission, he would present that to get the go ahead for that. And if they gave him the go ahead, then he would have to work. He worked with that other fellow called Dieter to go and actually, you know, create
the glass. The glass. Yeah.
And what was interesting, Dieter would actually go to the glass factory where the glass is being blown, where it's actually made, and make his selections. I never realized it was, you know, that much of a detail. And I think that is what made the final product so magnificent. Diane, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm just kind of familiar with the whole process because my roommate in college was a stained glass artist. So I had seen her, you know, her whole process of doing it. And, you know, it reminded me, the video reminded me a lot of what she used to do. But they were making windows for the cathedral in Washington, D.C. And I've been in that cathedral, so I know what it looks like. Wow. But I haven't been in there since they redid these windows because they had that earthquake that broke a lot of them, the original ones. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot of other damage to the cathedral, too. But I haven't been back there since that happened. So I don't know what these windows that they did look like in there. But the ones that were there before were magnificent, so I can't imagine what these other ones must be like. But yeah, when you go in cathedrals like that, and there's stained glass, that's the only light basically that's in those cathedrals. I mean, they have some lights, but you know, electric lights or whatever. But the majority of the light coming into the buildings is through the stained glass, and it's just, I mean, you have prisms of all different colors going on all the surfaces in the church. It's crazy. I mean, if you're in the color like most painters are, or most mm-hmm. artists are, I guess, I mean, it's just like, it's almost overwhelming because there's so much color everywhere.
Quite possibly, if you're not, they're not religious, if you spend some time in there, you might become religious afterwards.
Well, if you ever spend time in a church and you can see how the sun changes, like somebody was talking about that, how the light changes as the sun moves across the windows,
changes.
And how it reflects on different surfaces and it moves, and it is really, I can imagine back in like, you know, the times when they first built those cathedrals and put stained glass into them, how amazing, like overwhelming it must have been to the people at that time, because they didn't have windows in a lot of buildings then. I mean, it was just open frames where the, you know, where they're letting light in. A lot of people couldn't afford glass. So, to see the glass with all the different color and stuff, I can't imagine what it must have been like back then when they're, I mean, we're used to seeing them, so it's a little bit different for us, but it must have been really miraculous at that point.
Over in Europe, you know, a lot of the, what they ended up doing at the time when a lot of the original churches, when they were built, you know, in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, and the cathedrals, they didn't have, you know, stained glass didn't come about until like in the later 17th, 18th century. And when, you know, it was the technique of creating it with, of creating the glass and the artisan, you know, installed it. But what was interesting was the original purpose was because, you know, until the Gutenberg Bible, you know, came about, the majority of the populace who went to church, they didn't know how to read or write. And so as the homilies are being, and as they are being preached, about Jesus and about God and everything, these stained glass windows just enhance, and all of a sudden they sent light bulbs. Oh, that's what he's talking about. That's, you know, and it, they became a religious tool because the beauty of the sun, different times of day hitting the glass, you know, and coming in. And then they, at night they would have, you know, lanterns and candles, you know, over the next to the windows are positioned nearby at certain angles to cause the reflections, you know. And it was always a different aura or a different atmosphere, you know, depending on what time you went in, you know, went into the. Mm-hmm. So,
it just basically just brought the pages of the Bible alive, you know, because a lot of the people didn't read, you know, or couldn't read or weren't taught to read, you know. It's just really cool.
I come from that tradition and that feeling of stained glass. And it is really, all kinds of stained glass, when the sun hits a certain way, it's really beautiful. And, you know, with the different colors and reflections, but it is really hard. The contemporary type styles, I don't have the same feeling as when I see a church stained glass, you know, window. And also what is so sad, our modern day temple is our modern day societies and people who are throwing rocks at the windows and trying to destroy them. Where a lot of churches, to protect them, they put screens over, and inside that just completely destroys the atmosphere. You know,
yeah, they do have to put protective. I don't know what kind of glass they have to put protective glass and stuff over the outside of them to protect them.
But when the sun hits it a certain way, Those show up through the glass, and it just completely.
Yeah, then probably the prisms don't pop the way they should when they have to put those over them. But one of the things that really got me was the way that they actually made the stained glass. I did not realize that they had to gather just as if they were going to make a vase or another piece of glass, you know, glass object, like a bowl or anything else, and blow it out so big, and then finally get this nice great big cylinder, and then get it to the point where they cut it and then lay it flat on a surface and then actually smooth it all out to let it cool in a cool so that it was finally a flat sheet of glass. I did not realize how they actually got to that flat sheet of glass. Well, I did not realize they had to blow it.
Huh? That's hand blown glass.
Yeah. But
they do manufacture poured glass where they just pour it into a mold. And that's what you usually see like in the craft stores and stuff now. It is cheaper. It's a cheaper kind of like student grade paint as opposed to professional paint. Kind of same. Because I can remember going on trips with my roommate and looking for glass, and she would like hunt through all these piles, and they have them stacked and standing up so you can just turn them over and go through. And she would just go through and through and through and look at she'd be looking for like a particular color or particular if it's hand blown, if it way it was
when you pick up those hand blown places and look at them, they're just absolutely gorgeous. You can see the difference because they have the waves and patterns and bubbles in them from the hand blown, and it's so totally different from a poured sheet. I didn't realize there was I didn't realize how they made the glass. I didn't know that they actually had to blow it out to make it.
Peter was so respectful of the talents of Roland that he specifically went to the original glass manufacturer to get the glass he was going to use to create, the piece for Roland, and then of course afterwards when he would have a section of the window, done, and then Roland, and I didn't know that they actually painted, on those glasses. I mean, he said his paint was like a mixture of ground, very fine ground glass, and the paint adds the luminosity,
they paint it on and then they have to bake it, put it in the kiln to get it to stay on there.
Oh, can you imagine running a piece after if they accidentally let it get too hot in the kiln? Woo! After all of that work to get it to that stage, and put it in the kiln.
You know what? It came out in the video. What was also depressing was we went through from the beginning stage, from his drawing all the way up to the beginning pieces being completed, and the committee of the cathedral turned him down.
Rejected it, that would have been heartbreaking. After all that work.
He was good about it. He said it's for a reason. There's something, and then they finally, but then I thought, if those windows had been put in before the earthquake, they could have been ruined.
Yeah.
So God was protecting those windows until after the earthquake.
The poor man,
So maybe that's why they were not putting that's why the windows got rejected, because they were waiting until the earthquake came and then they were going to put the windows in after that.
I know.
But it's a shame that those two guys did not get to see the windows get put in. That was a heartbreak at the end of the thing.
Final salutation, to them after they had passed away, the windows got installed, and this was what in 2015, 2016, something like that. So it wasn't that long.
The windows finally got put in, I think, in 2014.
Okay. So it wasn't that long ago, when you think about it, but, that was, when I heard that, they had rejected it. Oh, that was heartbreaking. I took us.
They were sent bad photographs.
Yeah, all the labor and all the hours and hours of work that was put in it, and then to have it rejected.
How many years of work was that?
I think it was three. I think it was three, but I'm not positive.
Only three?
I think so.
About three or four years. But we're talking 40-hour weeks or more, so.
From the cartoon stage to all the way up to the point of Kind of being ready to be installed.
All that, you know, that first drawing, so they call it the cartoon. Mm-hmm. First thing goes to my mind, cartoons, I think of comics, you know, whatever. No, that's just the phrase they use. It's the initial drawing, they call it the cartoon stage. Yeah, but anyhow, I think that's enough talking about that. Now, because Diane had mentioned in last week that she thought we was going to talk to the video about how making, you know, how white paint is made and different kinds of white paint. And so that's what I was originally searching for. And then I came across a stained glass video that was really adorable and interesting. I did find a video from Mikey, Artist Problems from Jerry's Artorama. And Diane, did Mikey give you any new information?
I don't know if there was any new information, but he did talk about different whites, and I've probably used most of the kinds of whites that they manufacture, but at one point or another. But I pretty much mostly use titanium white now. I mean, every once in a while I use lead white, but I mostly use titanium.
Constance, what about you?
I used to use titanium all the time, and mostly now I'll put zinc or I put lead white and zinc out, and then sometimes if I need that extra punch, I'll put titanium out.
Yeah.
When I need that extra hit of brightness.
Well, when I
somewhere that I can't get it.
When I started this this artist journey, started painting regularly, started with acrylics, it was always titanium white. And then I saw some video about zinc white. The zinc is kind of transparent. So then I got me an acrylic, you know, tube, and it was rather interesting. Well, then when I switched to oil, I started out with a titanium. And oh my God, the oil titanium white just punches you right in the face. I mean, it's just so bright. So, you know, I was like, whoa, wait a minute, you know. So then I investigated the zinc white, and now I use both titanium and zinc, but I don't use as much titanium as I started out. I just, when I want to punch something up, when we really want to highlight something, then I'll use a titanium. But most of the time I use zinc white, and I like it because of its mixing qualities. The only problem is with zinc white, and even with, I haven't noticed it that much with titanium, but with zinc white, if I want to like create a hue of a color, I just need to use just a little bit of the quality. I end up wasting a lot of white because I end up making it more, you know, I can't get it that hue that I want because it just takes a tiny bit of the red or the blue or whatever, because it just, and you got to use a larger gob of white, you know, and if you're not, then even when I do that, if I put too much of the other, it still ain't right. So,
well, that's why sometimes I'll put the a little bit of titanium out when I need when I need to go very light with something, then that way, you know, if I'm not getting there, then I'll just take a little dab of titanium and throw it in there with it to get there quicker.
I find myself using more zinc white than titanium. And of course I've never tried the leads or whatever. And everything I've heard about them, it's just like they say in the, you know, like Mikey said in the video, they're really thick. So I'm not a heavy impasto painter. So
if you use the Mary J with it, it thins it down pretty quickly.
Yeah. And I don't use the Mary J because
no liquid. It's the same thing.
Because of the, you know.
You don't like the way it smells, but the liquid does the same thing.
It really bothers me. I think I'm allergic to the Mary J. It does. It just makes my eyes water, you know, and I can't have my eyes watering when I'm trying to paint. Yeah.
Like, liquid doesn't make your eyes water, and it does the same thing.
It's the laugh of laughing at my mother when she would be cutting onions up. You know, all of a sudden she'd be crying. Mom, why are you crying? You know why. These onions are. Well, the Marigé does that to me. It affects me like onions. It makes me cry. You know, it really bothers. So I switched to liquid.
Yeah, but the bottom line with the whites is, I mean, you can just experiment with different kinds and you know, use different ones for different effects. And they mix differently with other colors. So if you just experiment with them and, you know, until you find one that works the way you want it to and does what you need to do, then that's kind of what you end up using. But
yep.
There's different colors of white. Some are a little bit more yellow. Some are a little bit more blue.
Yep.
That's, you know, that was a point of for our discussion was, yeah, there are different, you know, there's different, just like there's different, you know, colors, and depending on the manufacturer of the paint and depending on the mediums, it reacts differently, you know, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I very much like Payne's gray. It's not a gray. It's a black. It's a form of black. But the reason why I like it is it's semi-transparent, but it has a slight blue tint, you know, to it. And I find that I don't necessarily need a real dark black. In fact, a lot of people go to, you know, ivory black, and I don't hardly use ivory black. When I want to make black, I mix my own black with ultramarine blue and burnt umber. It makes, and if I wanted to get a little bit darker, I throw in some thio green, and it makes a beautiful translucent black that I, you know, that I love. So these are with the M. Graham wanted oil paints. Now I haven't tried that same combination with other brands of paint, which I may end up getting a different, you know, a different shade or whatever. And, you know, I came across Payne's gray when I was in the watercolors, and I just fell in love, you know, with that color. So every time I want to do a paint that involved quite a bit of black, but didn't want a real dark black, then I would use Payne's gray. And it just, I just like it. But as an artist, like we said before, experiment. Try different, you know, different colors, and there's a lot, you know, a lot of varieties out there. Okay, you guys want to add any more, you know, to the conversation? I think we're about ready to wrap up, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. For our listeners, like I said, if you go to www.talkartpodcast.com, that's talkartpodcast.com, you'll see the two links for the two videos that we discussed. I highly recommend you take a look at that stained glass video by the master stained glass artist. It is just so intense and informative and very enjoyable that he was a true master artist when it came to stained glass. And there's not that many folks out there, because think about it, it's expensive. That's an expensive art form. You know, it's so... I think you will earn a whole new respect for the stained glasses that are in the churches. And I'll say, you've been listening to what? This is episode 125. There we go. And our last episode for November the 29th. And I'll say goodnight to Diane and Constance.
Good night, Clyde. Good night, Constance. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Clyde. Good night, Dan. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you so much for listening. And we will see you next month. All right. Bye-bye, folks.
The Artist Friends Podcast is produced and edited by Clyde J. Kale. Participating artists, Diane Hunt, Constance Bronson, and Clyde J. Kim. You can find more information about Diane Hunt at www.dianehuntstudio.com. Constance Bronson at www.etsy.com/shop/CBROSNANS. Clyde J. Kale at www.cjkaleartworks.com. If you would like to participate or appear as a guest on the Artist Friends podcast, please email cjkale@mystery-otr.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a thumbs up or a star rating. And most of all, send us your comments. This podcast is issued under the Creative Commons license.